today on Against the Grain, how vulnerable are cities to the weather extremes brought on by climate change? To what extent do rising sea levels and what's called the heat island effect threaten urban areas? And what does adaptation to global warming on the urban level look like and need to look like? I'm C.S. Song. Ashley Dawson discusses his book, Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Two monumental trends are converging. One is the movement, the massive migration of people to urban areas. The other is increasingly extreme forms of weather unleashed by climate change. This convergence of an urbanizing humanity with intense climate disruptions is what spurred Ashley Dawson to write his new book, Extreme Cities. In it, he describes both the unique vulnerabilities of cities in both the global north and the global south, and also how grassroots movements are acting to protect their communities and to remake their cities in a more just and equitable way. Ashley Dawson is a visiting professor at the Princeton Environmental Institute and an English professor at the City University of New York. His new book is Extreme Cities: The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. When Ashley joined me recently from New York City, he said this about the overall project of his book.
What I'm really trying to get at is the way in which cities are a real kind of key point for climate change. And that's what the title is really gesturing towards, the kind of conjunction of increasingly extreme forms of weather that are caused by climate change and anthropogenic carbon emissions, and then social extremes in contemporary cities, which make them more vulnerable to climate change related natural disasters. So that, you know, thinking about that conjunction is at the center of what I try to do throughout the book.
So urban dwellers like me, we like to think that, you know, we're in cities, so we're kind of protected, right? We have a built environment around us. So in some ways, we're kind of protected from extremes. I take it you disagree with that.
Yeah, I really want to challenge that in my work. So I want to talk about the ways in which actually through the creation of a huge amount of kind of elaborated infrastructure, we've made ourselves far more vulnerable to natural disasters. You know, if you live in a rural area and you're used to having to get water from the local river or something like that, a natural disaster could be decimating, but nonetheless, you have a sort of element of self-provision in a lot of parts of your life, which in a city you don't. You know, when you turn the tap and no water comes out, or when you flick on the light switch and you don't have electricity, you're suddenly incredibly vulnerable in a city. So while there are aspects of urban life that I think can increase our ability to cope with natural disasters, and that includes the people we find around us, and I think it's important to talk about sort of social resiliency in cities and the way in which we can depend on our fellow urbanites in moments of disaster. Nonetheless, yeah, I want to talk about the ways in which cities actually are highly vulnerable these days.
Cities, as you point out in your book, are vulnerable to sea level rise. What has the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, projected in terms of sea level rise over the course of the 21st century?
Well, its projections are fairly low ball. You know, they're telling us that it's going to be about 6 feet, more or less. But what I try and do in the book is talk about some of the problems in these projections. I mean, the IPCC, as its name suggests, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is a kind of political body. And so while the scientists who are part of it are, you know, crack scientists doing great work, nonetheless, their publications have to be vetted and approved by government officials. And so there's a lot of political pressure on them to get things right. And one of the things I try and talk about in the book is the way in which projections about sea level rise that scientists have made when they're giving them to official bodies like the IPCC haven't incorporated potential big changes like the melting of the glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland in past publications because of the uncertainty about melt rates. You know, so scientists wanting to make sure they don't get criticized for their science being inaccurate have basically just in the past not included melting of Antarctica and Greenland in their projections. And of course, we know that those places are melting. We just don't know exactly how fast, although we're getting better and better science to help us understand that all the time.
How quickly could the glaciers melt such that we have what might be considered catastrophic sea level rise?
Well, one of the most alarming predictions came from James Hansen, where he talked about really significant melting happening, and it happening in a fairly quick order, right? So Hansen talked about melting over the course of 50 to 150 years, that is really, really significant. Several meters he described, which, you know, is over 10 feet or so. This has all been debated and he's been criticized by some, but what I think is particularly interesting that I found as I spoke to scientists and read some of the debates going on in scientific circles about this is the idea that sea level rise isn't going to happen in some kind of smooth upward change, like a kind of hockey stick graph or something like that, but instead is going to happen through these kinds of fits and starts or punctuated rises followed by periods of relative equilibrium. And the reason that that's significant is that in our contemporary world, we tend to talk about risk based on projections into the future that come from experience in the past. But what we're entering is this new world where the past is no gauge for the future, and where these kinds of really rapid shifts in climate can take place that find us totally unprepared. And that's one reason that it's so hard for scientists to really find any kind of agreement about exact predictions concerning sea level rise.
The IPCC, in making predictions about greenhouse gas emissions, what do they believe in terms of how quickly or determinedly economies will move toward a post-carbon economy?
Well, Mike Davis has a wonderful article where he talks about the urban future, and a significant section of that article, which I cite in my book, discusses the way in which IPCC's projections for mitigation of carbon emissions, in other words, cuts in the amount of carbon we're going to be emitting, really assume that we're going to be putting whatever kind of capital we generate back into green infrastructure rather than into luxury high-rises and condominiums for the 1%. And if you look at the way in which urban real estate has been going over the last 30, 40 years, it's a huge economic sink for the elites. And in fact, we have this kind of irrational process of urbanization where we continue to develop coastal areas, take Miami Beach, for instance, because they're great places for the wealthy to park their capital. But, of course, they're absolutely insane places to be building houses.
To what extent, Ashley, is humanity urbanizing? To what extent are people converging on cities around the globe?
This has been one of the huge shifts of the last half century. In fact, Eric Hobsbawm, the great materialist historian, in his History of the 20th Century, says that this is one of the huge transformations of human history, which is all too little acknowledged. You know, we talk a lot about the fall of the Berlin Wall and the kind of triumph of the U.S. as the sole superpower, but we don't talk in enough detail about the urbanization of humanity. So from roughly the beginning of the 21st century, I think the official point was in 2007, 50% of humanity was living in cities. And as Mike Davis talks about wonderfully in his book, Planet of Slums, it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the urbanization that has happened over the last 50 years, and increasingly almost all of the urbanization that will happen in the future, in the rest of this century, is happening in developing countries, in other words, in the global south. So that the kind of paradigms that we have in our mind, those of us living in cities like New York or Berkeley, for what cities should look like, are really not up to speed for the ways in which global urbanization, planetary urbanization, is playing out now and in the future.
And we've talked to various guests on this program about why people are moving to cities, but can you share with us some of the factors, maybe some of the major factors that incline people or force people to move to urban areas?
Yeah, well, In my book, I talk about the recent wave of urbanists who have celebrated the transformative power of the city. And, you know, that's an old story, the kind of idea of bright lights, big city, of economic mobility, of the kind of attraction of cultural connection and social propinquity, which comes with living in cities. You know, there's nothing like the kind of hubbub of urban life. And, you know, I think that that's important. And I think that it is true that people can, to a certain extent, ameliorate their economic circumstances by moving to cities. But what often gets ignored in those kinds of celebrations of cities are the factors that are pushing people to move to cities, often against their will. And that, to really talk about that adequately, means one has to talk about the history of globalization and neoliberalism. In other words, one has to talk about the ways in which countries which had fought hard to achieve their independence from colonial powers and to begin to develop their economies in the period after World War II and from 1960 on, increasingly, when more and more countries became independent, the way that countries had tariff barriers and the sort of mechanisms of internal development that they'd put in place battered down by free trade agreements and various other forms of neoliberal globalization. And of course, in the global south, above all, that means the ways in which barriers that protected peasants who were based in the countryside were destroyed and demolished in various different ways. I mean, the classic instance, of course, is NAFTA. NAFTA was responsible for cutting the barriers that protected farmers in Mexico, and that led to a huge influx of cheap corn produced in the United States. And of course, it was produced by farmers using intensive fossil-fueled agriculture rather than small peasant agriculture. And that led to a shift of about 2 million people from Mexico's rural areas to cities like Mexico City and other regional cities. And, you know, a certain number of those people also came to the United States and went to other developed economies. So there's a whole history of urbanization which involves big mechanisms of contemporary capitalism and the kind of inequalities of contemporary capitalism that need to be taken into account when one talks about the contemporary city.
Ashley Dawson is a visiting professor in the environment and the humanities and a visiting professor of English at the Princeton Environmental Institute at Princeton University. He's also professor of English at the City University of New York. We are talking about his new book. It's called Extreme Cities: The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. It's published by Verso. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what proportion of urban residents around the globe live in low-elevation coastal zones?
I don't have the exact proportion on the tip of my tongue of people who live in coastal areas in the global south, but two-thirds of world cities are in coastal zones that are prone to floods. So that's kind of across the global north, global south divide. And what that, I think, reflects is some of the dynamics of globalization that we're talking about. And in the developing world and developed world, it also reflects the importance of port cities. We often don't think about port cities and their importance to globalization. You know, we think about globalization in terms of airplanes often, but Without the container ship, we wouldn't have the massive quantities of consumer goods being shipped from one part of the global economy to another. And what that has meant is that massive port cities have grown up, above all in East Asia, which of course is the center for global commodity production, but also in many other parts of the world. And many of those cities are in low-lying coastal zones that are highly prone to flooding.
What about in the U.S.?
Same thing in the U.S. All of the U.S.'s major cities lie in coastal zones, New York, all the way around to cities on the West Coast, and of course New Orleans, which strikes us very much when we think about climate change as a result of Hurricane Katrina. So our wealthiest cities are in coastal areas. That's not to say that there aren't threats which cities in other areas face. You know, the U.S. has seen a massive development of cities in the south and southwest of the country over the post-war period, and particularly speeding up from 1960 onward. And cities like Phoenix are very much threatened by drought and forms of heat that are coming with climate change. So I think it's important to talk about phenomena, not just flooding, but also the forms of mortality related to the heat island effect in cities, right? Cities basically are about 30% warmer than the surrounding countryside. And with that comes very elevated levels of mortality when the weather is extremely hot, as well as, you know, quite spectacular disasters like brownouts and blackouts as a result of the grid not being able to handle all the electric consumption when people turn on their air conditioners to try and cope with elevated temperatures in the summer.
Why are cities, on average, 30% hotter than the countryside? And also, do climate scientists pay enough attention to this urban heat island phenomenon?
Cities are a lot hotter because they have a lot more tarmac and, you know, bricks and other things in them that absorb heat and then radiate it into the surroundings. Related to that is the fact that when there is suburban sprawl, it often means that a lot of the natural greenery that was in the urban surroundings gets chopped down. And that can lead to much higher temperatures, and it can also lead to problems with flooding. I mean, that's very much what we saw when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston. You know, the city had sprawled massively as people moved to the exurban fringe looking for cheaper real estate, you know, in the absence of any kind of affordable housing policies in the city. And in doing that, developers kind of cut down a lot of the wetlands, and that then led to massive flooding. And yeah, in the book, I point out that cities are in some strange way invisible to science because of the fact that our measurements of temperatures tend to be adjusted to global norms. So, you know, when we think about climate change, we talk about global statistics. And that's also reflected in terms of our accounting for increasing heat as a result of climate change and other elements related to sort of data measurements. And so when weather stations do their recordings in urban areas, scientists tend to statistically adjust them down in order to get a kind of, you know, mean temperatures across the rural-urban divide. But of course, what that does is to make cities and their extremely often perilous, perilously hot conditions invisible statistically.
You mentioned, or you recall, of several terrifying heat waves that have afflicted Europe and India and New York City. What happened in northern India in late July 2012?
I wanted to talk about what happened in India in order to, you know, make the point that these kinds of hazards are occurring in multiple different places in the world, and that in particular, people in the global south are especially imperiled by these crashes and natural disasters. So in 2012, there was a heat wave across all of northern India. It impacted particularly strongly in New Delhi, where there was a kind of cascading power outage, and it had to do with problems in the grid in India, You know, India has a huge problem with inefficiency in its grid, although the United States does too, but in India it's even worse. And also, since the majority of people in India still live in rural areas, there are problems when farmers try and compensate for droughts by using a lot of electricity to pump water. It means that people living in urban areas have less access to electricity. And so what happened in 2012 was that there are these series of cascading power outages. And that kind of thing is really life imperiling because in cities, as I pointed out at the outset, access to water in many cases depends on access to electricity. You know, when electricity stops working, the pumps that pump water in urban systems often don't flow. This is a potential huge threat in India, and it is in the United States too. I mean, in New York, during Hurricane Sandy, when the power went out in much of Lower Manhattan, people living in buildings that were higher than five stories lost access to water because the water just wouldn't naturally flow above five stories. You know, it has to be pumped. And then when the electricity goes out, suddenly people living in high rises are in really grave, life-threatening conditions.
You referred earlier to slums in urban areas, in the global south in particular. You write that one third to a half of the urban population, I think this is in the global south, lives in informal settlements. What needs to be said about the vulnerability to environmental catastrophe of informal settlements and urban slums?
Informal settlements are usually on land which urban elites have not taken over for one reason or another. So almost by definition, that land is imperiled in various different ways, whether it's by toxicity in the land itself or by landslides in the event of some kind of natural disaster or by flooding. I mean, we could go on with all the different kinds of threats. But the point is that there's a kind of what Mike Davis calls a slum ecology, which is highly dangerous to the people who live in those areas. And so that the massive numbers of people throughout the global south who are forced to live on that land, and of course their ability to stay there is often precarious since they often get rousted out by the government without any notice. But adding to that precariousness, of course, is the increasing number of natural disasters, whether they're sort of slow moving like drought or spectacular like hurricanes and typhoons, which are affecting those areas. Just recently, I read that Cape Town, the city where I was born in South Africa, is likely to become the first city to have to start mass rationing of water to people who live there. That's likely to happen in April. What the article talking about that didn't talk about, of course, is that it's going to be far harder for people living in the townships where there isn't adequate transportation to get access to the rationed water than people who have cars and other forms of public transportation towards the center of the city, who tend to be more affluent and white as a result of the history of apartheid in South Africa. And those kinds of inequalities play out throughout cities in the global south.
What can the impact of floodwaters be in some of these informal settlements, given the lack of adequate sanitary infrastructure?
Yeah, there's also a whole component of, unfortunately, diseases which come when floodwater comes. It can bring all sorts of diseases in the event of the flooding, and then, of course, afterwards when the water itself is polluted in various different ways. I mean, given all of that and the importance to underline that as the most important thing to think about, nonetheless, I think that there are also elements of struggling and improvising with everyday life, which people in informal settlements are quite adept at, so that I think we have to temper the stories of the kind of menace which the extreme city represents to people in informal settlements with people's capacity for resilience and for kind of human infrastructure, for social connection in those places, right? And I say all of that because, remember earlier I was talking about the way in which planetary urbanization as it's playing out really is happening in a way that's very different from the kind of urban templates we have from the last 200 years of urbanization in Europe and North America. And because of that, I think there's often a tendency to look at the cities of the global south in purely negative terms, you know, just as spaces of kind of lack of infrastructure, lack of development, lack of industrialization. And that's obviously a problem. You know, it's a very kind of racist way of looking at things. So while it's important to acknowledge the challenge and the extreme vulnerability that people face, I think it's also important to talk about capacities for improvising and coping that people have developed and how that might help them weather the storms that are bearing down on people increasingly. And then to think about how that might be ramped up with help, I mean, with adequate funding from the global north, as it, you know, should be given to people in the global south for some kind of just transition.
Ashley Dawson joins us talking about his new book, Extreme Cities. He's a visiting professor at Princeton, a professor at the City University of New York. We'll take a short break and speak more with Ashley Dawson about his really interesting and timely book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ashley Dawson is a visiting professor in the environment and the humanities and visiting professor of English at the Princeton Environmental Institute. He has written books like Extinction, A Radical History, and in his more literary vein, I guess, The Routledge Concise History of 20th Century British Literature. And he has a new book out from Verso. It's called Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. You write that 1/4 of the Netherlands lies below sea level and half of the country is threatened by storm surges and flooding rivers. What kind of praise have planners in that nation attracted for their efforts to adapt to climate change?
Oh, Holland has attracted a huge amount of attention, both for its history of dealing with water, you know, through its famous system of dikes, and then for its contemporary efforts to come up with new ways of living with water. So Dutch engineers and water technicians have become consultants all around the world. I interviewed architects who've been working in Ho Chi Minh City, as well as people working in Florida. And of course, one of the most famous examples is the head of the Dutch Water Agency, who became the advisor to Obama's head of housing and urban development and the chief of the resiliency forming project here in New York City called Rebuild by Design.
So Rotterdam, a major port, I think you mentioned that it's like the biggest seaport, one of the biggest seaports in the world. You indicate that it's surrounded on all four sides by water, so you can't simply flush water away when it appears or when it rolls in. What has Rotterdam been praised for?
Yeah, Rotterdam is really interesting because of the ways in which it has taken the Dutch system of creating massive barriers against storms and innovated on it so that it can also deal with surging rivers. As climate change intensifies, it's going to mean more moisture in the atmosphere and consequently heavier precipitation. So not only more intense storms coming in off the North Sea in the Dutch case, but also rivers coming in to Holland, like the Rhine River, from the European heartland, which are going to be running higher and more likely to overflow their banks. And so Rotterdam has attracted quite a lot of attention because of its efforts to make room for the river, or to live with water and to create so-called living infrastructure. Perhaps one of the most famous examples of this is a so-called water park. The Dutch name for it is the Bentenplein Park. It's become well known because of the way in which it serves a kind of dual purpose. So in times of normal weather, it's a public amenity, place where people can enjoy themselves and be in public. But then when the city is hit by particularly strong rainfall, the park can be flooded and can serve as a kind of cistern for massive water so that it doesn't flood surrounding buildings. So that effort to use public space in a kind of dual purpose to absorb some of the flooding, I think, has gotten Rotterdam a lot of attention.
In 1953, a huge storm surge did tremendous damage in the Netherlands, killing almost 2,000 people and 30,000 animals. To prevent this from happening again, the Dutch built what's called the Delta Works. Describe the Delta Works for us.
The Delta Works are a set of massive storm surge barriers that the Dutch put up in the northwest and southwest part of the country. And what's interesting about them is, of course, they're these huge structures which prevent storm surge like the one that was killed so many people in 1953 coming in off of the North Sea and flooding Dutch cities and countryside. But they're also quite notable because of the flexibility with which they were constructed. So in particular, the one in the southwest of the country is built with kind of sluice gates within the structure so that essentially parts of the barrier can be elevated so that when a storm surge isn't coming in off the sea, the ocean can come and go as it normally would, or at least as close as possible to the way it normally would. And what that does is to keep the tidal zones behind the barrier alive and to keep the natural environment intact while also having the capacity to protect farmland and cities and other parts of the human world when necessary. So this innovation, these sort of sluice gates and the ability to open and close them, came as a result of pressure from both environmentalists and fisher folk in the area that would have been affected had the barrier just been a pure barrier. And so what it sort of revealed was the ways in which the Dutch were able to marry both, you know, massive infrastructure, which was supported by the state, with a kind of democratic input and flexibility in engineering that was really quite notable.
And what does that indicate to you about the validity of some of the books and other publications that have come out by people kind of celebrating planetary urbanization and specifically saying that innovations driven by free markets and the creativity unleashed by those free markets are what make cities great?
Throughout the book, I talk about the ways in which capitalist markets, particularly ones that are based in cities, are quite dysfunctional. I mean, I already alluded to the ways in which real estate development is taking place in coastal regions, in cities all around the world, and how that might be a good place to sink capital, in other words, to take over accumulated capital and make some money on it, but it doesn't make any sense in human and ecological terms as more and more people get put in harm's way and their property too, ultimately. But the example that we're talking about now, the Dutch example, I think shows that a lot of the really quite radical free market celebrations of cities as the solution to climate change don't make sense. I'm thinking here specifically of Matthew Kahn, who has a book about cities and climate change, where he says basically, and he's echoing arguments made by many other contemporary urbanists, he says that cities create this kind of ferment, this kind of space of entrepreneurialism, and that they're going to, in and of themselves, consequently generate solutions to climate change, right? So gathering people together, giving them access to markets, and putting them in harm's way in extreme cities, Kahn thinks will lead to solutions to climate change. And I think that just makes absolutely no sense. I mean, for one thing, cities are responsible for the lion's share of carbon emissions. You know, they're responsible for about 70% of carbon emissions. So they're a huge problem, and that has to be fixed, and the free market is not doing it adequately. So we need to have massive regulation, and that means state intervention, and it has to be intervention which is guided by grassroots movements. You know, it has to come from grassroots mobilization. And I think the Dutch example is a good example of that, right? You have these huge engineering works, really some of the greatest feats of human engineering in the 20th century, but they were carried out by a really remarkably democratic Dutch state, and one that was quite responsive, as I was pointing out earlier, to the criticism of engineers and you know, local workers, fisher folk, who would have been impacted if it had been a pure barrier. And of course, we've seen just recently how mobilization on a grassroots level can change the direction of cities. I really want to mention that quite recently, the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, announced that the city was going to be divesting its pension funds from fossil fuels and also suing the five biggest fossil fuel companies for willfully imperiling New York City. This is obviously a huge step and a quite historic event, but it's one that grassroots movements for divestment really fought for a long, long time. So it's another example of how the kind of massive regulation that we need, and also, you know, feats of engineering to protect cities, are only really going to happen as a result of social movements that push authorities to take the appropriate action.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ashley Dawson joins us. His new book is Extreme Cities: The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. What, if any, publicly funded infrastructure project undertaken in the U.S., undertaken in U.S. history, is of a scale similar to Holland's?
Well, I think that to really find something similar, you have to look back to the New Deal and the period immediately afterwards. You know, the construction of the National Highway System, for instance, is an example, although of course we're kind of saddled with that now because it's created a whole culture based on sprawling cities and automobiles, which is what we need to overcome in order to create a kind of sustainable civilization. But I think it's important to look back to that period to see that we have engaged as a society and as a nation in the kinds of massive engineering projects that are necessary for the future in order to make cities sustainable. And in the course of the book, I talk about some of the ones that New York City is considering for its near future. I mean, New York has already tried to climate-proof its subway system. The subway system, of course, goes back to the late 19th and early 20th century in New York City. But I think it's another example of a kind of really important feat of manufacturing, which transformed social fabric and which is responsible for the relatively small per capita carbon emissions of New Yorkers in comparison with people living in most other American cities. So it's a kind of point or two a way forward for us. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of the need for a new deal, a Green New Deal, for a kind of mobilization on the scale of World War II. That's something I talk about towards the end of the book and talk about what kinds of movements we would need to make that happen and what some of the objectives might be.
Well, tell me more. I mean, what kind of movements, what kind of initiatives need to be undertaken to generate momentum towards such a project?
Well, the recent meeting of the UN Climate Summit revealed that no developed nation and most developing nations aren't on track to keep to their voluntary cuts in carbon emissions, which was obviously very bad news. But even if everyone was on track with their pledges, we would be angling towards a rise in temperatures of 3 degrees. And there were a number of articles pointing out that this would mean that hundreds of millions of people in cities around the world are going to be faced with inundation. And to just to really bring this home, that the bottom third of Florida is likely to be completely underwater by 2100. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we're going to have to undertake all sorts of different adaptation efforts. These can be from a very kind of micro scale, like people putting solar panels on their roofs to, you know, mitigate the amount of carbon emissions that they're creating, or green roofs and green walls to absorb rainfall. All of that is on a very local scale. But New York City is also talking about much bigger projects, like putting up a kind of elevated berm or seawall around the bottom of Manhattan, which was inundated, and, you know, putting similar kinds of protective devices and infrastructure in place in many other parts of the city. In the book, I talk a lot about the need to think about equity and to have a kind of just transition, right? So there's a problem that when disaster strikes, it's affecting cities that are highly unequal, and consequently the impacts are highly unequal and highly damaging to people who are least responsible for carbon emissions and most vulnerable. And that continues to be the case, you know, as rebuilding happens after disasters. Again, you know, it tends to be disadvantaged communities that get the least aid. And we saw that playing out after Hurricane Sandy as well, of course, as after Hurricane Katrina. And we're seeing it to such brutal effect in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria last fall. So, you know, these are things that we see happening all the time. And so my book makes the case that as we begin talking more and more about adaptation to impacts of climate change, we have to make strong arguments around justice, social justice, and the need to create cities that are truly resilient because they're not as economically stratified. So I talk about some of the kinds of proposals that have been coming out of environmental justice movements here in New York. For example, I talk about We Act, which is an environmental justice organization based in Harlem. They put together a climate action manual, which is very much built on the experience of Hurricane Sandy and is trying to think about how to make neighborhoods more resilient, but is also thinking about the impact of gentrification, urban inequality, and the many other forms of attacks on low-income people of color communities in cities like New York that are taking place. So, yeah, as we think about adaptation, it's really important to fight for justice and to work with environmental justice movements and climate justice movements that are pushing that fight forward. And then as my comments at the outset of this kind of indicate, I think we're also going to have to think about not just adaptation, but also retreat, right? I mean, if we're looking at the bottom third of Florida going underwater, we're not just going to have to move people around within Miami, but we're going to have to deal with really large-scale displacement. And we have no national conversation about that right now whatsoever, of course. It's starting to happen within cities with the current government in place. It's really a non-starter. But I have to say, with the Obama administration, we didn't see much more of a conversation going on either. So I feel like we're only really beginning to grapple with this reality. And I think it's because of some of the ways in which cities are kind of invisible and that this threat still isn't taken seriously enough that we were discussing at the beginning of the interview, CS.
Ashley Dawson is my guest on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm CS Song. We are talking about his new book. It's called Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. Well, to what extent do you think reactions to projections of human-caused climate disruptions and climate disasters are rooted in denial or disavowal?
I talk about denial and disavowal a fair amount in the book. There is an element of that going on, and there's been quite a lot of scholarship to support that idea, particularly in developed societies, you know, in the global south where people are living, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa. The vast majority of people are dependent on rain-fed agriculture, and so the impacts of climate change are already a quotidian reality. People in the more affluent societies in the global north can, for a lot of the time, still afford to engage in denial and disavowal. I also talk about, though, the ways in which some of the science makes it hard to grapple with these phenomena, and also the ways in which our dominant cultural representations can create a sense of disaster fatigue or powerlessness, right? So the way in which disasters often get represented in Hollywood films, for instance, is as these phenomena which are scourges on society where there's a kind of war of all against all unleashed, and usually in most of these kinds of films that Hollywood produces, a lone white male hero sort of stands out and saves the day. And this is not just in natural disaster films, of which Hollywood has produced many, but also in films which I think in some indirect way register the coming catastrophe of climate change and social breakdown, potentially. And that's, you know, films like zombie films, for instance, which are pretty thinly veiled racial texts about the threat of the other under dire conditions. And so what I talk about in the book is the way in which that imaginary of catastrophe, social breakdown, and kind of violence of everyone against everyone is not really accurate to what we know happens in many disasters. In other words, when something like Hurricane Sandy happens, what we find often is that people turn to one another and engage in mutual aid. You know, they engage in solidarity with their neighbors and with people in their city and do their best to help one another out. There are these amazing acts of selflessness and of social networking that take place. And I document how that happened with Occupy Sandy and with a lot of the other kind of grassroots mobilizations that happened following Hurricane Sandy.
And what do pop culture representations of, for example, tidal waves inundating New York City, what do they ignore about the problems that can afflict urban infrastructures?
Well, Hollywood likes to have a spectacle. It likes to give us a kind of roller coaster ride of visual phenomena and emotions to go with it. And so what that means is that they have to emphasize things and amp them up to the point where they can often be completely ridiculous. In the case of The Day After Tomorrow, you know, where helicopters are freezing midair and, you know, plummeting out of the atmosphere as a result. I mean, not to say that there aren't dramatic natural disasters, and we've seen a whole slew of them over the last 4 or 5 months, you know, wildfires, over 41 million people were displaced as a result of a very strong monsoon season, abnormally strong monsoon season in South Asia, and then, of course, the strong hurricane season. So there are spectacular disasters that take place, and often with increasing ferocity, but there's also a kind of attritional destruction. And that's the kind of slow grinding wearing away of our infrastructures that support urban life. And that's something that happens as a result of climate change. You know, as temperatures increase, it's harder to maintain a lot of the physical infrastructure in cities. But then intertwined with that, of course, is the way in which neoliberal evacuation of support for the public sphere is imperiling infrastructures and making it harder to maintain things like New York's famous subway system that I alluded to earlier. You know, it breaks down all the time, anytime there's a strong rainstorm, and often even when there isn't any rain, the subway doesn't keep going. And in addition to the imperiled physical infrastructures in cities, of course, is the imperiled social infrastructure. In other words, if we're going to talk about urban resiliency, we have to talk about the ways in which physical infrastructures and social communities interact with one another, and the fact that people's capacity to survive disasters of the spectacular kind, as well as the kind of slow violence of gradual disinvestment, is diminished as a result of cutbacks that take place increasing ferocity over the recent years.
You cite two Dutch geographers saying that flood defense measures make certain areas, which are now protected from flooding because of these structures that have been built, more attractive for development. With what consequence?
Well, it's called the control paradox, right? So you build flood defense mechanisms of various different kinds, including classically, you know, a levee or a seawall or something like that. And that gives people the impression that everything behind those defenses is safe. And so you then have development in those areas. And often the defenses are not adequate. You know, either they're permeable or the seas rise and the storm surges are higher than anticipated, or there's water coming down as a result of precipitation that floods from the inside rather than from the outside. You know, a whole number of factors can take place, and you can end up actually having greater numbers of people at risk as a result of the defenses that have been built. So there's a real kind of control paradox there. And the place that I think that comes out most clearly in the United States is with the levees around the Mississippi River, which have essentially made New Orleans into this Atlantis surrounded by elevated water channels on every side. And, you know, the idea was to protect the city and surrounding agricultural areas. But what it's actually done is to, as we saw with Hurricane Katrina and after, has led to potential catastrophic failures.
Ashley Dawson, currently a visiting professor in the environment and the humanities and visiting professor of English at the Princeton Environmental Institute. He is normally based at the City University of New York, where he teaches English. His new book is Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. It's published by Verso. Ashley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, CS. It's been great speaking with you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.